behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. We are joined, as always, by our Car Stuff pit crew. I decided we could call them now, right?
I like it.
We got Dylan, we've got Matt sometimes, and we've got, of course, Noel. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, ladies and gentlemen, you are you, and you are here. Thank you for dropping by. And welcome to Car Stuff, as Scott said earlier at the opening.
Oh, that's all right. That was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago. Water under the bridge.
Yeah, really. You got to move on, Ben. You got to move on.
I got to move on.
Yeah.
So let's move on right now. No sense standing on ceremony. Scott, you made my day earlier, a few weeks back, when you hipped me to today's topic, which is something I had no idea about and came to us from a listener mail.
Yeah, I can't take all the credit for it. This came from a listener named Bill S., and Bill S. wrote in with a long note. This is the guy that was the Japanese consulate in Detroit. He's the or he works for the Japanese consulate in Detroit, I should say. Maybe I said that wrong the last time, but he works for the Japanese consulate in Detroit. I should make that clear. Anyways, he had a bunch of stuff to say here. It's kind of a big grab bag of material, and one part of that note that I was going to read initially in a Nuts and Bolts episode a couple months ago, I didn't get to it. He mentioned something that was really, really intriguing, and I thought you would find this interesting, and you did. So that's today's topic. Just out of an excerpt out of the middle of this note here says, "As part of my job, I read a lot of news publications out of Ohio. I found this article about one of the hundreds of automotive companies that sprung up and died in the opening decades of the 20th century." We talked about that in one of our podcasts, right? The I think it was Defunct Automobile Companies or something.
Yes,
like that?
Yeah.
Long, long time ago. This one is named Templar Motors. Interesting name right off the bat, right?
I mean,
makes you think of something. So it says the company even has a Masonic link that might be of interest to Ben, if he's feeling particularly conspiratorial.
Bill, you know about the other show.
Yeah, that's right. So, Templar Motors, and this is exactly what the name implies. This has a Masonic link to it.
Yes, the company was active first in 1917, right? They started in 1917, and they were named for the Knights Templar.
Yeah.
It's unusual because a lot of car companies will just take the last name of the head guy, right?
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is the head guy, or guys in this case, there were three of them, were all Knights Templar. They were all they all had that ranking in the Masonic organization. So the guys' names were Arthur M. Dean, J. E. Matthews, and then Matthew F. Bramley, and they were all, again, Knights Templar. They are the founders of what eventually became known as Templar Motors Company. Initially, it was just called Templar Cars, I think, or Templar Motors. There's some restructuring that happens a little bit later on. Mm-hmm. The history of this place isn't very long. It's only about 8 years, but it is pretty interesting, and there's some little tidbits of information that go along with this that I found really intriguing.
Oh, yeah.
We'll try to touch on some of that, but it's funny. We've done this in the past when we talk about these, but I mean, this is a failed car company, really. It wasn't successful.
Or did it just go underground?
Okay. I wondered how many times you're going to use that voice throughout this podcast. So there's one. I'll mark them right here. One.
Okay, all right.
One.
No need to get paperwork involved here.
All right, so Scott. It was called Templar from about 1917 until 1923. Mm-hmm. Then there was something that happened we'll talk about in a minute here, but it became Templar Motor Car Company from 1923 until 1924 when it went out of existence.
Just 1 year.
Yep.
So the three guys who get together, of the three, the original president is Matthew Bramley. He was the founder of the Cleveland Trinidad Paving Company. This place had a lot of history with Cleveland. They laid the first asphalt-paved road in town. Hmm. The Templar plant was at 4000 Halstead Street. They designed their own engines, and then they built them in their own factory. They used just a single chassis for the entire product line.
Yeah, and all this has changed a little bit because we're talking about a company that was around right at the end of World War I. So the city has changed a bit, and we keep mentioning that it's in Cleveland or it's in Ohio. It's really in the greater What do you call it? I guess the greater metro area of Cleveland.
It's a
city that borders Cleveland. So you can still say it's in Cleveland, I suppose. But the city itself is Lakewood. And Lakewood, Ohio, and the street that this this factory now sits on is called Athens Avenue. So if you're looking for it, it's on Athens Avenue.
Yeah.
Right
I
near
think
the water.
They called it Halstead Street when the factory was in operation.
That's correct. They did. Yeah. I'm trying to say like all these things change over time.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
the city
kind
of develops and changes as things happen. But they're just off of Lake Erie. They're right there on the water or near the water anyways.
So this is a nice factory. They're an upstart at a time when upstart motor companies were way more common.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we did some on defunct auto companies before, we mentioned the soda comparison.
Yeah.
Right? So for anyone who doesn't know, in addition to being very well versed in automotive history, my co-host Scott also knows a weirdly thorough amount of stuff about soda history.
Yeah, I don't know why that is. I just kind of been
just
interested
pick it
in
up,
it. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, here and there.
And so one of the things that started in the early days of soda manufacturing was that numerous companies would open up. Everybody and their grandmother's cousin had their own sarsaparilla outfit or something.
Yeah.
And eventually these things either fall to the wayside or they get acquired by another increasingly successful company, and then boom, you have just a few big dogs running. That seems to be how business goes often.
Yeah, or they try to grow too fast. You know, they buy too much of like a property that's too big for them, or they try to fulfill orders that are too big for them to fulfill, and that's what ends up happening. And they take out loans that they can't pay back. That's where a lot of those small companies went under.
And that applies to small companies in general. Yeah,
And that happened a lot with soda and with car companies.
Yeah.
So we talked about the thousands of car companies that went under in the United States, but just to give you an idea of how competitive this was in this era when they opened. To stay around 8 years is not too bad, really, for them. So Templar was one of more than 80 car companies that operated in just Northeast Ohio alone. Did you hear me? 80 car companies.
Wow.
Did you hear me, Ben?
80?
I'm trying to emphasize that.
You said eight, right?
No, I said 80. 80 car companies in Northeast Ohio alone. So it gives you an idea of like that region, how many upstarts there were. And some of these, now we have to admit though, some of these didn't even produce more than one vehicle. Some didn't produce any vehicles. They were just on paper alone, never got off the ground.
And many produced very, very small numbers, very, very small productions.
And even this company, which eventually, as we'll find out, they produced around 6,000 total in the end.
Yeah.
That's still considered a very small company. And I guess, you know, if you want to put it this way, it was a failure, really, because it only lasted 8 years. And I know there are moments of success there, too. I mean, I totally get that. But anyways, it will be written about as, I guess, a failed car company, if you look at it that way.
Right.
So this car was kind of something special, though. It was a luxury car. But it was also – this is weird. The way they describe this is a couple of different ways. Maybe first what we should tell them is that it wasn't really a car that was entirely built in-house.
Yeah.
This is an assembled car.
Yeah.
So what they built –
a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, what they built – Templar designed and built their own engines. Ooh. So that's what they did there at the factory. They designed and built their own engines. But then they also would take – you know, I mentioned these other 80 companies that are in the area that are building cars. They had custom-built pieces made at other factories that would be then shipped to them at Templar – and then assembled. So this is an assembled car, really, using their engine. And they all used the same single chassis for the entire product line. And then each of the bodies were built to, you know, whatever specifications they wanted by three different companies.
Mm-hmm.
And those companies were the Lang Body Company, the Ohio Blower Company, and then a company called Rubay Company, Rubay. And so you could get one of these, you know, many different models, of course, and you know, you could do custom things with those models. But, again, they're all built on the single chassis. They all use the same engine at the time.
Yeah, and this was not by any means uncommon. I would say this was more the rule than the exception for a lot of car manufacturers at the time, or, you know, like custom coach builders would be given a chassis and an engine and then build around it in some cases, right?
Yeah, it's not unheard of by any means. Mm-hmm. So nothing unusual. It's just another, interesting little tidbit about this company. And as you would imagine, you know, because of the Masonic roots with these guys being Knights Templar, its emblem was the Maltese cross, which is, of course, associated with the Knights Templar, the Templar Knights.
Right.
Yeah,
we didn't even talk about this.
How about this? Why don't you tell us what the Knights Templar, what they consist of, maybe?
Oh, man.
Am I saying that right?
Yes, I guess so. So the Knights Templar, the official name is the Poor Fellow Soldiers of Christ and of the Temple of Solomon. When they started, they became one of the wealthiest and most powerful Christian military orders in their heyday, existed for nearly two centuries.
They were fighters, right?
They were fighters. Yeah. They were fighters in the Crusades, and they were like elite fighters. They were the most skilled. The Catholic Church did endorse them in the 12th century, like 1129, late 1120s.
Okay.
I never thought I'd say that sentence.
Close enough.
Yeah. So they were tied to the Crusades. That's how you hear about them a lot. And I think – now, someone correct me on this. Fellow Indiana Jones fans, I'm leaning on you for this because I'm winging it here. But I'm pretty sure that, spoiler alert, in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, a.k.a. the best one, that shots fired, that that ultimately he does – Indiana does associate with Templars, right?
Yeah. Okay. Maybe this is – I haven't watched it in 15 years, Ben.
What are you doing, man?
I don't know, but
– Do you want a DVD? I have three.
One of the Knights Templar that's guarding the chalice?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's right. The guy that – tells him he's chosen wisely.
Yes.
That is a Knight Templar, or a Templar Knight, I guess.
I think it is. I may be incorrect, but I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. There's a tie-in there.
I would put dollars to donuts on it. So eventually, the Knights Templar, the historic original version, gets into some trouble, and the Grand Master of the organization is caught and tortured, and the Pope at the time, Pope Clement, decides to disband the order, but the group continued, according to different stories you'll hear in different other groups. So Knights Templar in Freemasonry is a little bit different. That would be let me take a breath before I say it. The full name of the Knights Templar in Freemasonry is the United Religious, Military, and Masonic Orders of the Temple and of St. John of Jerusalem, Palestine, Rhodes, and Malta.
Wow, they have to have a huge business card. Like, really big.
Yeah.
Maybe two-sided.
Maybe it's tiny print. Maybe it folds out.
That's a long name. I wonder why they have such an overly complicated name for themselves.
Well, a lot of that stuff comes from tradition, I imagine. Now, just for full disclosure, Scott, neither you nor I, nor Dylan or Noel are ourselves Templars, right, or Freemasons.
Are you sure of that, Ben?
Wait.
No, and now a word from our sponsor.
What? And we're back.
That was an interesting conversation.
Yeah, yeah. Shame it happened off air. But thanks for setting me straight, clearing that up. So the reason Bill is busting my chops just a little bit there in the letter is because I work on another show that encounters what people call conspiracy theories, and you've probably had a lot of folks who you've run into before who are excited to talk about Freemasons or Masonic orders.
It's very mysterious.
Or things related to that because there are various conspiracy theories surrounding it. We don't have to get into those today, but I will say both for the Masons who listen to that show and the Masons who are listening to this show, we had, when we looked at it on our conspiracy show, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, we had some of the greatest people writing into us and saying, hey, like, thanks for, you know, not falling for all the crazy tinfoil that you hear.
Can I tell you this?
Yeah.
I know people that are involved in that that organization, that group, family members even, and they do a lot of good for the community. A lot of good for the community. Look at the Shriners.
I knew you were going to talk about
Shriners
that.
Are a branch of this mm-hmm. whole thing, right? And,
yeah.
And the Shriners, they do amazing things for children. You know, it's a really good organization. It's not just that one branch either. They all do a lot of community service. It's all about serving, really, for them.
Right. And as a outsider for this organization, I freely admit I am not by any means an authority mm-hmm. or even really conversant in the way that the various degrees work or the way that the orders work.
Yeah, you'd have to be on the inside to know that.
Yeah, you'd probably have to be on the inside. So if there's anyone who is a Mason who is checking out this episode and I just botched something in my description, then I do apologize and I welcome any correction via email. We give our email address at the end of the show every episode.
Oh, you're opening yourself up there.
Yeah, I am, because it's important, especially when something, you know, when any organization is like targeted by someone else and you have a bunch of rumors spreading about you, then, you know.
Absolutely. We don't do that by any means. In fact, we're probably the opposite. We're more like spreading the good word, really.
Yeah, except for you know, flying cars, the Honda Odysseys, I think, are two main.
Yeah, we may have made some enemies there.
If you're writing to me about the Honda Odyssey, then delete
your email. I'm writing to you from my Honda Odyssey.
So I derailed us just a little bit, but we thought that was interesting because given the way that the public perceives Masonry and Knights Templar, it's a very interesting choice for the inspiration for the car. And the cars they built were, you know,
well,
I was
kinda, they were something special.
Yeah, I was pretty captivated by them.
Yeah, there's something to them. I didn't mean to cut you off. You had
no,
more to say there.
Right.
But they're marketed in a couple of different ways. And this is really pretty fascinating to me. They're called a luxury car, but they're also a small car, sort of like what a sports car would be today.
Yeah.
Only they weren't really sports cars. I mean, if you look at them, you wouldn't say sports car, but not in today's terms, of course. But back then, even I think they were sportier cars. But it's just a strange way that they've associated themselves with a couple of different things here. But I can see the luxury aspect of this because they were a bit expensive. I think that, you know, in the initial year in 1917, I think it was.
Yeah.
One of the cars, you know, I mentioned coach builder, Roubaix, right?
Uh-huh.
One of the, that had a coachwork, the coachwork that was done by a guy named Leon Roubaix sold for like $4,250 back in 1917. And if you take that to 2016 dollars, that would be like a $68,000 car.
That's crazy.
Now that's during World War One, because World War One was going on between, 1914 and 1918, I believe it was. So that's the last, you know, the very end of that when they started production. And, of course, you know, that plays into it as well, you know, what they did with their facility there. And in just a moment, we'll talk about that. But these cars, I said there's something special about them. And they really paid a lot of attention to detail when they put these things together.
Yeah, okay.
One of the first things is really impressive.
Yeah. Which one?
The paint.
Oh, yeah. Every car, every single vehicle. And I think at their peak, they were making 8 vehicles per day in their factory. Every single vehicle had 27 coats of paint.
27 coats of paint on every car that came out of that factory. That's amazing. I bet you would never see that stuff peeling. It's probably hard as a rock when it came out of there, too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like almost like the enamels of today, you know, like the real mm-hmm. tough stuff.
But
well, hopefully it was that way anyways. Paint wasn't then what it is now.
Right. You know? Oh, yeah. No kidding, man.
Yeah.
So they also had they had a 5-passenger touring car and a 4-passenger Sportette model, but they were both built on the same chassis.
Yeah, right? And they had these really unique features, right?
Mm-hmm.
So all these cars would have these really interesting add-ons, I guess. Some of them, one thing that they had was an inspection light, which is powered by the car's battery. They also had an electric horn, which is pretty unusual for the day. They had a tire pump and a compressor that was powered by the car's engine. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, so if you get a flat or something like that, that's really innovative for back then.
Windshield wipers. They had a toolkit on board.
Yep. They had a jack for, you know, the spare. I guess that was unusual at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They had a locking ignition, which was unheard of.
And there's another cool thing here.
Yeah, the roadsters, right?
Yeah, the Roadsters, the Templar Roadsters, came with a camera, a Kodak 3A camera and a compass. And I think that's so cool. That's such a good way to get people out there, you know, because we have to remember the roads are kind of rough in this situation.
Yeah, right? I mean, this is exactly what they wanted people to do with their product. They wanted them to travel out to the country outside of the cities and see some of the land, see what's going on. Take some photos, bring them back into the city.
Why did I say in this situation? I meant in this time period.
It's okay.
But yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's a win-win for the car manufacturers at this time. You know, there's no interstate system yet. So travel of this sort is still going to be turning people's heads when you go through town. So essentially every time a Templar motor car or heck, any automobile goes through a small town, it's automatically advertisement for that manufacturer.
And, you know, I mentioned all that laundry list of things, or we did. That was all standard. That wasn't things that were, you know, optional equipment. That was something that you always got with a Templar when you bought it brand new. So it's loaded with features. And you just mentioned advertising, right?
Yes.
I remember hearing an interview with the guy. There's a guy that we're going to talk about in a moment that has a collection of these. And he'd mentioned in one of these interviews that the advertising, the print advertising, was geared towards women. They were focused on women in the ads, like women drivers. I don't know if it was made like a car that was marketed for women or not, but he said the print ads were always focused on the women.
Why is that, Scott?
Well, I don't mean like models or anything. Right? Yeah. I mean, they were like to be the people that were to buy and use these vehicles.
Like the female demographic.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know why that was. And they didn't include anything, you know, hokey or anything like that. It wasn't like the Dodge LaFemme or something, you know? Like
yeah.
They had like those just really...
Oh, that's so... condescending.
I was going to say condescending. Yeah. The stuff they would put in the glove box, like lipstick to match the paint and, I don't know, like a purse or an umbrella
and
or
some
something.
Gloves or something.
Yeah, it was something like, really kind of crazy.
Here's a way to hold your face powder.
Yeah, it was awful.
Very strange.
Yeah, it was awful. It was nothing like that. It was just... It was clear in their print ads that they wanted women drivers in these things. So it's an interesting thing for 1917.
And
let's put it that way.
You know, I've got a follow-up, though, on – I don't know if you saw this in the research, but one thing that I thought was really interesting, we already had some of your famous calculations of inflation there for a bespoke vehicle, right, that was custom coached.
Yeah.
Their typical car price ranged from $2,000 to $3,500 over the length of the company. And
still a little bit expensive.
You're right, Scott. You are right. $2,000 in 1917 is about $37,700 in 2016.
Okay.
So what's interesting to me about that is a little high, but it isn't completely out of the ballpark of what we would consider the average price of a sedan.
Well, it's not like a Duesenberg or something like that.
Right, you know, or Packard.
Or Packard, or what were the other ones? The three Ps, right? Peerless, Packard, and I can't remember.
It's not Pierce Arrow.
Pierce Arrow.
It is
Pierce Arrow, yeah.
Oh, is that why there's all this confetti and balloons dropping down in the studio?
Nice work, Ben. Nice work. I can't remember anything. That's good. So, it wasn't something like that, but it was sort of expensive, but not the most expensive, maybe.
Yeah.
And then there's a list of cars, you know, that was similar to in price, I guess, or right around the ballpark.
Yeah.
Or some of the few lower too, like Oldsmobile Runabout or, the Cole 30 and the Colt Runabout. They were all a little bit lower. Or probably about half the price, really, is this vehicle. One other thing we should point out here is that in, you know, when the time frame that we're talking about, you know, like as the company progressed, or maybe I need to go back a moment here. How about that?
All right.
Let's go back.
We'll rewind.
Because we kind of glossed over the war era. Going back to the war years, and again, this is World War I at the very end when they started production, which is just terrible timing. I don't know why they would attempt that, but they started in 1917. Of course, it went on until 1918. They had to back production way down. They didn't completely stop production. They built about 150 cars in 1918, but they did also contribute to the war effort, as did almost every automobile manufacturer in the United States. They built at that factory. They built artillery shells for the war effort, and there was a certain size that they built. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was their part for the war, and they backed production way down. And I would guess that I'm not going to say this for sure, but, you know, the war ended late in 1918. I wonder if the production number is so low because they started production at the very end of 1918. That
right.
might be the case.
They only made around 150 cars that year.
Yeah, so, I mean, that could be, the, you know, the last 2 months of the year. It could be that they were just building one or two here and there in between, mm-hmm. you know, these shell orders. I just don't know what the exact situation was there. But so they've got this... This car factory up and going again in 1918, and they're successful. As you said, they were at peak. They were building what, like eight cars a day,
and then in 1919 they really started cooking with gas because they added another body type. They had three body types: the coupe, sportet, and sedan, and they had like 900 employees.
Oh, that's big.
Yeah, so they were growing.
Well, the factory, you know, we mentioned this factory a couple times. It's, yeah. it's 300,000 square feet of space. It's a big factory.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a lot of room to do this. And you said 900 employees. That's pretty big. They built 1,800 cars in 1919.
And this, and that's just 1 year. And we also have to consider, you know, at this point in history, these are all pretty much handmade.
Yeah.
And these,
well, they are all handmade. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No robots making, welding.
I don't need to say pretty much, yeah. And this is also the post-war boom. So a lot of companies are growing, and there are also, because of these increased economic opportunities, more people are capable of buying cars.
Yes,
too.
So they increased the price a little bit. In 1920 yeah. and 1921, they bumped the prices up a little bit on their cars. And, of course, people paid that because it was a quality vehicle, right? But you have to understand, too, that the car had been unchanged from the beginning of the company until now. I mean, they added this one sedan body style, right? And that was about it.
Yeah.
The car itself, the chassis, the engine... you know, the basics, I guess, of the car. You know, you can still get custom coachwork done, but it had basically remained unchanged. And in, what was it, 1920, I guess it would be after 21. In 1922, they started to announce a couple of cheaper models. You know, there was competition that was, you know, as you said, this is a post-war boom, right? So a lot of companies
yeah.
are doing what they're doing. There's a lot of competition out there, and they decided that they needed to create some cheaper models, and they came out with this Roadster and this deluxe sports model, which came in at just under $2,000. And you said $2,000 was ballpark, what, $30,000?
$37,000.
So a little more affordable, I guess, for everybody at that time. You know, proportionally, if you want to put it that way. But these models that were now a little bit cheaper, you know, the Roadster and the Deluxe Sports, I should say, came about right after something major had happened at the factory, something that was a bit of a setback to the company itself, right? Kind of the downturn of the whole company.
Right. And we will, downturn is a very, is almost doesn't do it justice.
Okay, this is the onset of the demise of the company.
Yeah, the beginning
and
of the end.
It happened in 1921, but we'll tell you when we come back.
And now a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Scott, yes, as we said earlier, all the cylinders were firing, everything was going gangbusters.
Yeah, right? They even had new models.
Even had new models.
Yep.
From about 1917 to 1921, but then something happened. What?
In December of 1921, a major fire swept through the entire factory. Just gutted the whole thing, and there were receivers that were appointed in October of 1922, and 1922, as we said, you know, they had these new models that were supposed to be coming out, but they're trying to deal with the damage that this fire had done to the factory. Eventually, you know, the company was forced to refinance, and it became another company at this point. We mentioned the new name change, right?
Yeah.
It became Templar Motor Car Company in 1923, and then they started to work on a brand new engine. They were going to work out something for a larger car because they thought the future was in larger cars. They had, you know, these smaller but well-appointed cars. They wanted to do larger luxury cars at this point. So they were working on a 4.3-liter six-cylinder engine at the time in 1923 when they switched names. These new models were based around a 122-inch wheelbase frame, and they had a range of four- and five-seat bodies. So this is, again, 1923. This is right near the very end of the company. We're getting there, right? It's not good for them. Another bit of a technology, I guess, that was introduced was four-wheel brakes, which is funny to think of that, mm-hmm. you know, you didn't have brakes on all of your wheels at that point. But again, four-wheel brakes, I don't think they were the first to do that by any means. But 1923 was kind of a, I don't know, not a great year for sales for them.
No. Unfortunately, it looks like their peak years were behind them, and they were put in a situation that a lot of younger car companies would find themselves in, which is it's almost like growing a plant or something. The conditions have to be just right for some plants, like a very fragile plant mm-hmm. when it's a seedling or sapling or whatever. And if one thing goes wrong, then it can spell the end. So they never really recovered from that fire. And their sales, as valiant as the effort was, you have to ask how long they would have existed.
Well,
you know?
Here's the problem. In 1923, yeah. I said it was a bad year for sales.
Yeah.
They only sold 125 cars that year.
It's a bummer, man.
Yeah, that entire year. And, I mean, you can understand coming off of the fire and the damage and the loans and the, you know, just trying to battle back with, you know, new product. And
a lot of that's production time,
man,
too.
There's a lot going against them here. And in late 1924, the money just simply runs out. They can't do it anymore.
They defaulted on a loan, right?
Yeah, they defaulted on a loan. They had to pass the ownership back to the local bank. And the bank had called in a loan, of course, and production ceased. And, it just didn't work out for them. 1924 was the end of this whole thing, or was it?
Bum, bum, bum.
Well, I didn't know if it was that much of a cliffhanger. But,
I know. I thought a little sound design would help it out.
Well, sure.
Plus, I'm a sucker for that sound cue. Mm-hmm. In 1925, before we move on, in 1925, the factory itself reverted to, I think, the ownership of the original president.
Yeah, Bramley, right? Yeah, and then after that, it became a fastener company. And then I think it changed names again, but it's still kind of a fastener company because the current name, the place is still there. It's called the Erie Screw Company for Lake Erie, which is right nearby.
Yeah.
So it's still around. This factory is still around, but it's not really – I don't think it's producing anything right now, is it?
Now I think a lot of artists reside there.
Yeah, it's kind of a, I don't know, it's a mixed-use place, I guess, maybe. Is that what you call it?
Yeah,
like, you know, artists hang out there and create and live. And there's more to it than that, too. There's the guy, there's a guy in town mm-hmm. who is a collector of Templar motor cars. And he very, very shrewdly, very wisely, early on when there was property available there, when he knew that there was space to rent in this building, this Erie Screw Works building, he leased out a significant, you know, room in this place, and that's where he parks his Templar car collection.
In the Templar Motors factory display.
How cool is that?
That is really cool, and it's great that people are able to look at it, too. You know, if I could be candid, it sounds like the screw factory is very similar in some ways to where I'm living now, which is that old Ford factory.
Yeah, it is. It's very similar to that.
Yeah, so I've got a little bit of envy because there's not a display of, you know, the kind of Fords that were manufactured there. But also, it's kind of a wild place. So,
well, it seems to me, though, like with the history of the place that you live in, that they should maybe have one on display. Management should buy one, even if it's not in the best condition.
Yeah.
Just one for display. Like it's a nod to the history of the place, really. I think that's something that a lot of places do. You know, if they inhabit a place that is famous for something.
Yeah.
Do you have photos on the wall or anything like that?
Property manager's office, but honestly, man, some of those tenants, I wouldn't trust them around.
Anything nice?
Yeah.
Okay, I understand.
But
I get it.
Makes you sound like a bad person.
No, I get it. It's just that it shares a parking lot with a murdered Kroger.
I should mention that, too. It did share a parking lot with the Kroger that in Atlanta is known as the Murder Kroger. But I don't live in a bad neighborhood, you guys.
Oh, no. We would never say that.
Yeah, we would never say that because Snakebite will find out.
That's right. So the guy that was so smart to lease some space in this building, his name is Dave Bueller. Mm-hmm. And Dave has a collection of about a dozen of these cars, which is extremely impressive because, you know, the numbers that we told you, the low production numbers, relatively low, 6,000 cars total, they think that only about 30 of these cars exist in the world today.
Right.
That's a ballpark. Mm-hmm. No one's really exactly sure, but, you know, 30 is right about where they're comfortable saying that's the number that's out there. He has 12 of them. And, or about 12. I don't know if it's exactly 12. And he also has a ton of, memorabilia. And you can go there, and this is maybe one of the most fascinating parts of this thing. And I've got one more little story I want to tell you after this, but this is the guy that again, has the space. If you call, and you can do this on the Templar Motors site, you know, there's a Templar Motor Car site.
Yeah.
And he operates that, and you can call and request that he show you around the property there. I guess it's just free admission. He'll show you it by appointment only. So you can't just walk up and go in unless there's like an open to the public day, which I don't have any knowledge of right now. But
right.
You can contact him, and I don't have any of the contact information, but if you go to his website, it's just Templar Motors, you search it, you'll find it. It's right there in Lakewood, Ohio, and again, it's probably the largest collection of Templar Motors memorabilia and cars that you'll ever see in one place. I can say that for sure.
Yeah.
It's the largest you'll see.
Right. I have immense respect for people like Mr. Bueller because what they're doing there, I personally believe it goes beyond collecting cars. And collecting cars and preserving them is also a noble pursuit, in my opinion.
Sure.
But to share it with the world this way, you're becoming an historian. And because he is the expert here, he is the historian.
Yeah.
And I would love to bend his ear about some more information about Templar.
Well, he's the go-to guy for sure on this, mm-hmm. this subject. You know, I mentioned that there was one other thing that I wanted to mention regarding this topic. And it's something that had just – I don't know if I ever even – you know, let this register in my head when I've heard about this. But I think we've all heard the name Cannonball Baker before, right?
Yes.
The guy, the name E.G. Cannonball Baker.
Uh-huh.
In 1919, this guy Cannonball Baker set a world record for speed by driving a Templar vehicle from New York City to Chicago. So this is not coast to coast. This is New York to Chicago in 1919 in 26 hours and 50 minutes. That's a long time to get
Holy
there.
Smokes.
But you got to remember the condition of the road,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Now, if the name Cannonball Baker, rings a bell, the reason is because it's tied into NASCAR history as well. And he was also the inspiration for the film Cannonball Run in the 1980s because he was the one who first drove. Well, I don't know if he did it first, but he did it fastest. He drove from New York to L.A. In fact, I know he didn't do it first. He drove from New York to L.A. In a record time in, again, another Templar car in 1920. So a year later he did this. He crossed the entire nation in 6 days, 17 hours, and 33 minutes. And, I mean, one of the little bits of lore around this the story. Now, remember, this is almost a week-long trip to get across the country. Supposedly, he never took his shoes off the entire time.
Oh, gross.
So, yeah, I know. But I think what he was saying was, you know, in his interviews afterwards, that he never had time to really rest. You know, that it was on the road the whole time, he and his mechanic. And it's quite a tale, really, if you read about, you know, the Cannonball Baker's run across the United States. Now, again, he's not the very first one to do it, wasn't it? That was the subject of a PBS documentary, Horatio's Drive, I think it was.
Yeah.
The guy that
we talked about it.
And it inadvertently became a race because a manufacturer tried to do it. He was a privateer.
Right.
And a manufacturer heard about it and tried to catch him and mm-hmm. pass him before he made it.
You know, and he went with his mechanic with him, too.
Yeah, and a dog named Bud. Yeah, that wore doggles. Remember those?
Yes.
Yeah, there's some really cool photographs and some really – man, that's a great story. I love that story.
Yeah, it was the inspiration for Air Bud.
And it was not. I almost went on and just said, oh, yeah. But really, this Cannonball Baker guy – and I should also point out that the guy that did the Horatio's Drive thing, I can't remember his name exactly, all of it, but – he was not in a Templar, but Cannonball Baker was in a Templar car. And again, he used that vehicle to kind of showcase the durability and the safety of the vehicle in making these long-distance journeys way back then.
So the Templar Motor Company, in summation, was making quality vehicles, right?
Yeah.
And they were on the higher end because they were emphasizing luxury.
Yeah.
But they really had, you know, they were smart about the way they went with and followed through their business plan, But the problem is that sometimes these kind of catastrophes just occur. You know, a fire is like a...
It's a devastating thing to any small business, really.
Yeah, and it's not predictable.
Yeah, and I mean, I call it a small business. It wasn't really a small business, but it was a business with 900 people. It's devastating to a startup company like that, you know, early on in their history. It makes you wonder, though, had that fire not happened, would that be a name that we would be far more familiar with today? I mean, would they have gone on to success, or would they have kind of fizzled out? I mean, you never know.
Would we be driving Templars?
Yes. I mean, so many of those companies went under, you know, then. I'm not saying that they would become one of the big three. It'd be like the big four, you know, be like Ford, Chrysler, GM, and Templar.
You can dream, though. I would love to drive a car that was a Templar car.
Well, it'd be kind of cool. It would be. And, you know, if you go to this factory, too, you know, you'll see the Maltese cross on the windows, and it's all over the cars. I mean, there's symbols all over those cars.
Right. And the symbolism is not just some aesthetic. Oh, this looks cool. It does represent, you know, I think beatitudes or principles, mm-hmm. values,
sure,
associated with the Templars, which I think is neat. Every car has a story, and this just has a really interesting one. And I gotta tell you, man, I was having a hard time finding out how the fire started.
Yeah.
And I really want to know.
Oh, come on.
No, I'm not. Look, I'm not spinning any tinfoil tales here. I just want to know if it was a... I want to know just... that's all. I want to know what happened.
All right. Well, let's also point this out. Cleveland is awful close to Detroit, isn't it?
Holy smokes. I didn't even think about that.
It's really close.
It's very close.
So it's a possibility.
No.
There's always a possibility, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's more than likely that, you know,
it was
in 1921, maybe safety standards weren't quite as high as they are now, Ben, and you know, some sparks from the coal burning furnace in the wooden storage area.
And they did have
a wooden
lot of
storage area. just have a shed full of wood in the middle of the factory.
And they did have a lot of paint.
No, I don't know. I have no idea. I'm just saying that, you know, they did have a fire. It was devastating to them. I just wonder what would have happened if they had been allowed to continue past 1924?
Me too.
You know, would it have lasted until 1928, or would it have lasted until 1975, or would it still be around?
You know what? I am going to say you're right. I thought you were coming in to bust up my conspiratorial nature, but now you've got me thinking. and to be honest, yeah, it was probably, as you say, Scott, due to safety standards that weren't where we're at today. But I will point out that there are two cases of the big auto manufacturers shutting down some sort of competitor unfairly. One is the streetcars out there in California.
Sure.
That really happened.
Yep.
Well, in numerous small towns.
Yep.
And then the second is Preston Tucker.
Okay.
I will take that to my grave.
I would buy that, and I've heard many other people that argue against that.
Yeah, we've had some people who say, no, Preston Tucker really was doing essentially like a scheme.
Yeah.
You know, and we know what those scheme things we know what the schemes look like.
Yeah.
Nowadays.
Yeah, we had some more information on this one that, I mean, nothing that we had personally, but it's just information that's out there. You just have to dig and find it, but there's more to the story there. Okay, so, wow. But you know what? Okay, here's one more little thing that, that could have happened, I suppose. I mean, there are 80 competitors right in that very area, like in that tight little area.
Yeah.
Or more than 80, I should say. There's a chance, I guess, that somebody, you know, had some bad blood there with Templar Motors and didn't want to see them, you know, be as successful as they were in the previous 5 years.
Haters.
Yeah. I guess it could have been haters. Yeah, sure.
Oh, that's probably...
You know what those haters are going to do.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what they were saying back then.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am interested to hear more about the circumstances, and I may reach out to Mr. Bueller, too. If I manage to make contact with him, then I will come back in later episodes with an update because I am convinced if someone knows more details, then it's going to be him.
Yeah, and you know what? Any of our listeners can do this too if they decide they want to go on a tour of this place, because all you have to do is contact this guy on his website, and he'll take you around. Again, it's by appointment only, but you can go to the building that is now the Erie Screw Factory and take this free tour. And I bet he has some fascinating stories. He has a lot of tales to tell about the Templar Knights and about the cars themselves, and maybe even knows the inside scoop on that fire.
Yeah. So let us know if you hear back. You can also check out more of our stories on car companies of yesteryear by visiting our website, carstuffshow.com. Going to go ahead and give you an insider tip, ladies and gentlemen, gentlemen and ladies. If you haven't checked it out before, and if you are a fan of true crime, check out our episode on the Dale car.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Boy, that ties it all together, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does.
Yeah, it really does. That's a strange tale.
Yeah, and that's another I don't want to spoil it.
No, don't spoil it.
You're just going to have to check it out.
The Dale is it's an interesting, weird story.
Oh,
it really
man.
Is.
Yeah,
it really
that
is.
Was,
well, you know, we should thank Bill S. for, you know, cluing us into this topic again. Because,
yeah, thank you so much, Bill.
It's fun to look at history like this.
I had no idea. I had never heard of the Templar Motor Company, and that's a little weird for me.
I've never seen one before. I mean, but then again, I knew about Cannonball Baker, but I just never I don't know why the word Templar never really struck me.
He drove across in a Templar. Mm-hmm. I mean, it talks about it, and we've done shows on some of those things. But yeah, so thank you so much, Bill. We hope that we did this topic relative justice. If we haven't, or if you have any complaints, you can email us directly. We're jonathan.strickland@howstuffworks.com.
Yeah, and you can get as mean and as nasty as you want with us. It's fine. I mean, you just gave them the address, and you can type in all caps if you want. We can take it.
Yeah,
you
know, include a, what do you call them, a GIF? you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are CarStuffHSW, and you can see some neat things from time to time that don't make it to the air on the show, or you can interact with us directly, especially if you catch me on Twitter during happy hour.
Ben, I wonder if Jonathan has any idea that we use him as like our complaint side. I wonder if he's really getting any of this stuff.
Oh my gosh. Okay, here, I'll tell you the truth. So, this is a guy's a coworker of ours, friend of the show. We've guested on each other's podcasts. He's the host of Tech Stuff and a show called Forward Thinking. And both Scott and I have been on his show
multiple times.
Yeah. On Tech Stuff. It's a great show, and if you like engineering, you like mechanics, you like the future of technology, or even the past of technology, we wholeheartedly recommend it, not just the episodes that we happen to be in. But I wrote to Jonathan, I think it may have been on Twitter or something, man, and it was on Twitter or it was in an email where I said, oh, hey, I forgot. I almost did that joke that you do where you tell somebody to send their complaints to someone else's address. But then I stopped because I didn't want to steal your thing. And he shoots me a look that is as cold as the Arctic on winter solstice or something. And he says, that's not my joke, Ben. That's your joke.
Oh, boy. So maybe.
So I think he has had a few emails.
He might have received a few notes.
I think he may have.
This is funny. He's never talked to me about it.
He's never talked. That's the closest. Okay. But if so, Jonathan.
Ben apologizes.
I was going to say I would like to be the kind of person who would apologize. Dream big. 2017. But yeah, in all seriousness, if you have some more information on the Templar Motor Company, we'd love to hear from you. If you have some recommendations for topics you think your fellow listeners would enjoy in the future, then take a page from Bill S. and write to us directly. We are
CarStuff@HowStuffWorks.com.
That is our actual address.
That's the one.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.